And now, here's your host, Dr. Carlos.
Welcome back, everyone. We have a great topic with a great guest, and I can't wait to get into it. It's Stephen Langton, L-A-N-K-T-O-N. You can find him at langton.com, L-A-N-K-T-O-N. He's the editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Clinical Hypnosis since 2005, the author, co-author, or editor of at least 19 professional books, more than 60 peer-reviewed chapters. He's got two Lifetime Achievement Awards, but today we're going to be talking about hypnosis. That's right, folks. You've heard about it before. We're going to find out a lot more about how it's used actually in a clinical setting. And we'll dispel some myths too while we're at it. Why not? Before we get started, make sure to share, subscribe, hit that like button. You know we like it. Let's not waste any more time. Welcome to the show, Mr. Langton. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
Thank you very much for doing this. We had a great conversation before the show. It's an amazing history you have. You've met some incredible people over the years. There's no doubt about it, but I know one person you didn't meet, but I guess we'll start the conversation with him. Franz Mesmer. Now, the reason I bring up Mesmer is because hypnosis has got a weird rap. So I want to kind of get the air out and get that out of the way before we start getting into clinical hypnosis. Mesmer was one of the earlier ones that I know. I'm sure it's probably people who've done hypnosis hundreds of years prior to that. But can you tell us a little bit about, I'll start off with this question. Tell us a little bit about, is there a difference between what a magician would do, a hypnotist, compared to what a clinical hypnosis practitioner would do?
I hope so. And in some cases, sadly, no. And that's not a comment about the stage hypnotist. It's a comment about the training of the clinical hypnotist. Just to shine a little light on history here, there were Aesculapian dream temples all around the Mediterranean, about 1,000 of them. And when Constantine took over, he had them all destroyed because of the pagan aspect of it. And in these dream temples, which you can still visit, and there's some museums that still are on those sites that you can visit, there are testimonials of governors and so on. There's one particular one from the governor, big plaque of his ear, because the trance that he went into cured this. And what happened there was people would go to sleep in these dream temples, and presumably Asclepius would visit them and tell them what to do or just flat out cure them. And it's not real clear what the heck was going on there. But, and by the way, there were lots of little snakes running about these temples. Purpose, they had some affinity for them. And that's where the caduceus symbol probably comes in, with the snakes wrapped around the staff. So later on, some folks like Janet and Charcot, contemporaneous with Freud, had discovered this phenomena, which in 1841, James Braid labeled as hypnosis. And it was, Bernheim had called it suggestive therapeutics, which was a pretty good title for it, actually. Probably should have stuck, because the name of hypnosis comes from the Greek hypnos, who was the son of Thanatos, as I recall. And those all have some pretty bad associations. By the way, his sister was Hygina. So you get the words hygiene from that. And Freud studied this for a while. They were basically using it to suggest away symptoms, and they didn't know what they had on their hands at this point. They didn't know how to name it, even, as you know. And they found a great deal of success also using imagery, even back in those days, to pair, like, say, I don't know if this is one that they used or not, but water flowing through a pipe to help blood flow through veins, that, for example, pretty simple stuff. Then Freud denounced it because he preferred, he had a couple of reasons. One of them is he preferred and wanted to promote free association. One other reason was that he certainly thought that it interfered with the transference that he was trying to analyze. And he also had a woman that had kind of a wild moment where she jumped on the couch or embraced him or something, that interpersonal behavior in his Victorian training was really uncomfortable to him. So at least for those three reasons, plus some fight he was having with Nancy France and trying to remove himself from that group. Once Freud had said it was not a good plan and that free association was better, and then it ruined transference analysis, then professionals, for the most part, eschewed it. And they're moving away from it. Then the whole field put it in the land of weird and mysterious and alternative, sadly. But Anton Mesmer helped make it even worse when he thought that he had a line, a beat on animal magnetism, and that he, or some other instigator of the therapy, possessed this magnetism. And so he wooed people all the way to into the royalty of France. And at the end of his reign of misunderstanding, you might say, came when Vasier and Guillotin and Ben Franklin, who represented the East India Company, went to France to look at what this was about and see whether they felt it was scientific. And there was I don't remember exactly how it went, but they did a kind of a double blind experiment. And they, well, it wasn't double blind. They knew that a particular tree had absolutely no magic magnetism from Mesmer, but the patient who thought he was getting a hit from this magnetism didn't know it, misrepresented, you know, represented the wrong item for bringing him the magic cure. And so they went back and announced that Mesmer was a fraud and that this information that he was promoting was not empirical or correct. And that in a way took down some of the potential medical use of hypnosis. And then it got into popular press, of course, because of Dracula. And the doctor who figured out Dracula's lair was a good guy. His name, there's a lot of shows with his name in it now. I can't think of what it is. Oh, Von. And
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, he was a doctor in the original drama book, and he used hypnosis to find out from the woman where Dracula's lair was. But of course, in all future representations, Dracula used hypnosis to control people and so on. And a very good article about this by the head of psychology, Deirdre Barrett at Harvard, head of psychology at Harvard, wrote an excellent article about the historical misrepresentations and bad representations in media. And that's in the American Journal of Clinical Hypnosis. And I think it's in the year 2006, late 2005, early 2006, or I believe you'll find it there. And excellent article, even has photographic captures from a real good history of what went wrong with the reputation of hypnosis. And it should have been, you know, it probably should have been called suggestive therapeutics and just left at that, because Bernheim had a great title for it back in those days.
Fascinating.
Oh yeah, so you asked me. So what happens often is a carryover from these really ancient approaches where the idea was that it was similar to sleep and hence hypnos, who takes over things when you sleep, or I don't know how that works exactly, more complicated on who's running who into Hades back in.
That's right.
Brush up on that a little bit. Since it was associated with sleep, you hear this redundant use of the word, you know, go to sleep, go deeper and deeper sleep. When you close your eyes, you fall asleep. When I snap my fingers, you wake up. This entire matter of associating it with sleep, which it clearly is not associated with by any kind of neural activity that can be measured nowadays. It's more associated with waking state, actually. Secondly, the idea that you can just, I wish I weren't even saying this phrase, but implant an idea in the unconscious and the person has to follow it. And so the idea of directly suggesting away a symptom has stuck for years. And in some countries where I've taught, that whole idea of this authoritarian approach of telling you to sleep, telling you that you're going to wake up happy as a bunny and that your symptoms are gone and you won't remember what I've told you, that's kind of the routine under which hypnosis practitioners operated for a couple, for several decades, and some still do. And that's how it interacts with people who do stage hypnosis, because those folks do that very thing. They take an authoritarian stance, they make direct suggestions, and let's switch it back to therapists for a minute. When you do that, you're putting yourself in the role of an expert. I don't know, I'm not an expert in what caused your vomiting on a daily basis, but if I take that position, all of a sudden I am, and then I, you know, presumably make suggestions telling you not to vomit anymore, that you'll wake up feeling, you won't feel nauseous. And to the credit of some of these folks, like even back to the days of Freud, hypnosis was used in what was called hypnoanalysis to ask for an elaboration of what led up to the production of this neurotic situation and these symptoms. At least that would give you a ecological or potentially an ecological background on what did lead up to those, to the symptoms, you know. More modern approaches now have emerged. Some of them are a little simple, like cognitive behavioral hypnosis or cognitive hypnosis, and some are a little bit more complicated, like Erickson's approach to hypnosis, which is what I found fascinating when I studied with Erickson. So in those cases, we're not talking about anything similar to what happens on stage hypnosis.
Amazing history. I guess a litany of questions now. You know, we're going to get to Erickson in a minute. I guess one of my thoughts were, did the repressed memory era, remember that? Did that hurt the industry as well?
Did it what?
Did it hurt the hypnosis industry as well?
I wouldn't say that it did.
Okay. Because I know they were accusing them of implanting suggestions.
It hurt a lot of things. You know, hypnosis was already disallowed from court testimony. So to have
you're saying
there was a big controversy for a while. Some people thought, well, if I can raise this memory in hypnosis, it's got to be true. And that's simply not the case. Memory is quite malleable. And very small cues from the therapist can shape the final product of what's reported as a memory, as well as just a person's own creative symbolism. People who were in a very tough divorce, thinking that they've remembered a Civil War memory. And it is a Civil War. It just isn't that one. It didn't happen at Appomattox or Gettysburg. And what I noticed was, it didn't last. So when you say hurt the field, it didn't have lasting effects. But when I was training around the country and world at that time, there were a remarkable number of young therapists who would say, I've got a caseload of multiple personalities, and I've got a caseload of satanic cult survivors. Really? How in the world did you manage that when Erickson and, you know, all these other folks who Hilgard and Kroger and these folks who are really good therapists and MDs and things like that, they didn't manage to find that many in their world around them. And somehow you have a whole caseload of them. And it sounds a little bit more like you're manufacturing that symptomatology by perhaps the way you're asking questions or what your expectancy is and how you reinforce with your expectancy what the other person says so that you shape it, you know, just flat out shaping in operant interpersonal behavior.
Fascinating stuff. And I guess before we get into clinical hypnosis and how do you use it, maybe the different disorders that it works most effectively with and all this other information. I have one question for you. I'm curious. I remember reading Erickson's books, and I don't know if you ever saw it in action, where he was known for being able to shake somebody's hand and within 10 seconds put somebody under. Was that just hyperbolic because of him trying to create some kind of hero or image, superhero image, or was it real?
No. He was trying to make a point, and it can be done. I was asked to do this in a workshop in Norway. So a woman who had just arrived late came in and said, use her. So I did. And the idea is the disruption of the social norm that occurs when you shake hands causes You know, we don't, I say causes, there's no empirical evidence for this, but it's reasonable that what happens when I'm touching your hands in ways that aren't normally touched during this handshake induction, and I hold it a little too long and I hold it in the wrong spot and I'm looking at you, and so you can't really politely readjust and pull your hand back like you might do, you're conscious expectancy is your social interaction ritual is broken, and your conscious set, you could say, to use Erickson's word, is depotentiated. So while your conscious frame of reference is temporarily interrupted, it makes it quite easy to retrieve, or quite possible to easily retrieve other resources, especially if you happen to be intuitively keen on what this person's all about. If they're in your office because they feel insecure and you're doing this and you say something to the effect of, why don't you close your eyes and concentrate on what you think is the reason for your insecurity while you sit in that chair, that makes more sense to me because that's pretty relevant. I wasn't planning on getting around to saying that till after we shook hands, but I don't know if that'll ever end. So you go into trance, and that's all there is to it. The surprise induction works that way as well. So it is a little showy and it's a little stupid, but the point is that it does happen and it can be done.
And that's amazing stuff. I always remember
nobody would do that as a, you know, part of their therapy repertoire unless they wanted to see the board of a professional regulation.
I always found it interesting. I think it was called he called it the hand induction in his book or something like that.
Induction.
Yeah, amazing stuff. I guess we go into now clinical hypnosis. So how is it being used in today's world in therapy? That's a broad question.
Well, it'll by a huge number of people, quite a broad spectrum, including those who are doing research. If there's one thing that you could say without it being much of, if any, of an overgeneralization, is almost any intervention that has been used in therapy and compared to its use while the person is in hypnosis has been found to be more effective with hypnosis as an adjunct. So one thing we should say is hypnosis is not a therapy. You don't get better just because somebody hypnotizes you. Now, if the act of taking 10 minutes out of your life and relaxing is helpful, which it very well could be, you could see some improvement, my anxiety dropped and so on. Or if your expectancy was such that you proceeded to project some placebo effect occurs as a result of going into trance, but the trance itself, the hypnosis itself is not curative. It's, you could look at this, Dr. Carlos, you could look at this as another part of the spectrum where seeing a whole neighborhood together like Speck and Apne did way back in the 60s, or seeing a family together, these are just different contexts for seeing the identified problem system. Seeing the couple together, that's a different one. Seeing the individual alone, that's a different one still. The individual, the couple, the family, the group, the neighborhood, these are all contexts, C-O-N-T-E-X, contexts for doing therapy. And hypnosis is the same. It's just another context where you actually are not using the individual's conscious mind as a, you know, filtering everything, but you help the person relax that filter and those limitations that it brings so that you can help them get in contact with other experiences and reorganize those to create the outcome they seek that they can't do on their own. So hypnosis is a context for change. Once that context is established, once you've seen it, just like when you're sitting down with an individual, that doesn't help anybody get better. Well, there's a little bit of research that shows that women in groups, cancer recovering people in groups, do get better because of the group activity, but the activity has to do with the therapy, or the therapy has to do with whatever that activity is. So sitting down with somebody doesn't make them better. you have to sit down and do an intervention or two with that person of some kind. And likewise, putting a person in trance doesn't help them get better, but the interventions that one does in the hypnosis, that's the critical thing.
That makes a lot of sense, because I know some people will try to use it. Well, there's a lot of misunderstanding in the media. I guess that's why I'm glad you talked about it earlier as well with Dr. Barrett and some of the work, because I think hypnosis is sometimes can, people still have a really bad impression of it and they don't understand it. And of course, when the legal system throws it out, then it hampers it a little bit as well. Right. I like the way you described it as an adjunct. Is there any particular disorders it tends to work better that you've seen? Is it better with anxiety, panic attacks, depression, all the above, none of the above?
Well, yeah, there are some aspects of symptomatology for which it hands down is the intervention of choice, and any of the anxiety, part of the anxiety, I don't think I should say the word spectrum here, but since that's not a thing, but you know, you have trauma, you have childhood redundant trauma, you have, and then I meant the acute trauma, like an auto accident, you have various anxieties from social anxieties and phobias to the temporary anxieties that diagnose the situational anxiety disorders. And all of those anxieties are actually easily ameliorated, because what you're doing in hypnosis is you're helping the person retrieve the experiences they can't get a hold of. So let's say I'm in an auto accident and I used to be able to drive a car and sing songs at the same time and then never even give it a thought particularly. I'd check my mirrors and I'd remain relaxed. And then I get in a bad accident. Now I've got this phobia of driving. I get in the car. I don't sing songs. I feel tense when I look in my mirrors now. What has happened? What's different? Well, what's different if we look at it, speculate looking at it at least neurologically, is that neurons that fire together wire together. And so what used to happen when I drove was I could, whatever neurons were firing for the perception of the mirrors and the road ahead of me and calculating the speed of the oncoming cars and the feeling of the seat and whether I've turned the steering wheel a little bit with my, you know, geo sensors in my fingers. Those associations are part of what occur in the stimulus of this car and the driving and the road. They're all one big fat gestalt. But now someone slams into me, and another part that's entered into it is a set of tension and fear and scare and trepidation and helplessness and pain that I didn't have associated before. Now those perceptions are firing together and wiring together when they didn't before, and I have a trauma. So when I get in the car, rather than my brain firing off these neurons that used to work nicely together, they're firing off these neurons that don't play well together, and I have a trauma. So analyzing my childhood is not going to help this any. What's going to help is if you can temporarily disrupt my conscious mind recognition of those things happening, those firing together, help me retrieve the experiences, even the ones I used to have of being relaxed and singing a song and enjoying the, you know, the weight of my body in the seat without thinking about it and so on. So that, because I've lost, if I've got the trauma, I've lost my ability to consciously or unconsciously retrieve those experiences. So what we want to do is help you reassociate the desired experiences in the context you need them. And in some cases, you need to inhibit the traumatic events as well. That's an extra piece. But that first part applies to all anxieties, basically. If I can help you associate to the needed experience in the context in which it's needed, you don't have a problem. And that's what Erickson considered a cure, was having the resources you need in the context in which they're required. Now, depression is another symptom for the use of hypnosis, for the interventions used in hypnosis. I Yeah, this shorthand that we end up saying when we need interventions in hypnosis. There are a number of other things that you might not consider because they don't fall into a diagnostic category. Like how do I tell my mother that I was raped? You know, when my mother already has enough problems on her hands, if I tell her, this will just hurt her a little bit more. And I'm not really displaying anxiety about it. So it's not something that shows up as a DSM problem, but it is a problem. It's a communicational problem where I substitute some other feeling over the top of it, like some other affect over the top of it, like I can take care of myself. The I can take care of myself syndrome is not in the DSM. But on the other hand, if we look at this through a transactional analysis framework, for example, that's a substituted racket that I do to get attention in place of showing the real feeling I have, which is a need for help. I had a client like that very thing, and she did vomit 8 times a day. That was a symptom she brought for a year and a half. She'd been doing that, and they'd taken out her spleen. They'd done all kinds of neurological tests on her. They couldn't figure out. And if she wanted to take an anti-nausea injection with a quite long needle in her thigh, she could get that down to maybe 4 or 5 times a day, the vomiting. Now, the hypnosis wasn't used to get her to stop vomiting. She was having that kind of a reaction because she had converted it, and she had converted her anxiety and fear about her hurting her mother and so on into this symptom. You know, you could get all fancy about it and say, you know, it kind of made her sick that happened, but it's just semantics. Bottom line, that wouldn't help her get better. What I did use once I hit upon this dynamic with her, which was in the third session, I think, then she told me what had happened and that she couldn't tell her mother. And so I used hypnosis for her to rehearse explaining this to her stepfather and explaining it to her mother with her stepfather's help. When she did that, she didn't vomit again. And she hasn't vomited again since that happened. She still had nausea. I had to do a little more work because I didn't realize the other aspect of it was she had shunned any kind of help or support for fear that that would make her cry and break down into telling the truth. So I had to help her undo that as well. And those interpersonal rehearsals were done in hypnosis. So hypnosis was there and the behavioral rehearsal, and it could have been psychodrama. We could have done it probably. We could have done it in an empty chair in Gestalt probably. Probably could have done it in fantasy, in waking state. All of these would have been, you know, group or individual or hypnosis. But in hypnosis, you get a much quicker gluing together of experiences. So what fires together wires together quicker, I think you would say.
Oh, fascinating stuff.
And there are a lot of other aspects, but we wouldn't break it down by symptoms. So if a person came with pain, there's another excellent symptom for the use of hypnosis because you can help retrieve feelings of dissociation and analgesia. And if someone came and they were schizophrenic, you couldn't say, well, I'll use hypnosis and help them with schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is a very highly packed situation that to keep my schizophrenia, I have to perceive in a certain way. I have to interpret my perceptions in a certain way. I have to interact with people in a certain way. Each of those things might be a good target for using interventions in hypnosis.
Let me ask you this. Some thoughts were coming through my head as you were talking. I had a series last year on trauma. So I talked to probably names you've heard, Pat Ogden, Roger Solomon with EMDR. And I know there's that element in trauma, disassociating individuals.
EMDR is Shapiro.
Shapiro, yeah, Solomon, well, she's passed, but Solomon, I guess, worked with her. But I guess I'm trying to see if there's a connection here, because I know when you work, there's two schools of thought, obviously, but one of the schools of thought is you want to disassociate what you can, that memory from that temporal that time, right? So there's a kind of like a temporal shift that you want to cause in that individual so they don't believe it's happening right now at the moment when they recall that, as I think it was Bessel van der Kolk who talked about in his book. Is that similar to hypnosis? Is it possible to do that with something like for PTSD or something like that, or somebody who's been molested as a child?
One of the things that I've found about EMDR that Francine Shapiro and I spoke about this a little bit, and I had her on the editorial board for a while because people would often want to conflate the two approaches, and they're really not the same approach. They do have something in, they may have something in common that, though the, when I think about something being recorded in my memory someplace, I often do it with a particular muscle set that orients my eyes in a way to help me retrieve, if you will, that experience. EMDR screws that up by having you remember the trauma while you're not allowing the eyes to be focused in their normal location. Now, that has been systematized in that approach to being back and forth at a certain speed. Actually, Steve Andreas, who we were speaking about before, did a couple workshops, even wrote about the fact that it doesn't have to be back and forth. It just has to be different. And then you, once you break that ability to store the data there, retrieve the data stored there, you break your unconscious access back. Oh, let me tell you about a client that is similar to this. In behavior modification, I think you'll find this in Bandura, Albert Bandura at Stanford, 69, wrote a book called Principles of Behavior Modification. And he wrote about a lot of different interventions there. One of the interventions is reciprocal inhibition. And the idea is that I can't entertain two things at once with the same integrity that I could entertain either one of them. I went to New Haven, Connecticut for one of my year-long training things I was doing once a month. So when October came, I didn't go back until I think late January because we had the November holidays, the December holidays, the January holidays. And so there was a several month gap. And when I went back, doctor who had been sponsoring it, I asked him how he was. He said, well, I've been, my father died, and he glanced in a certain place up to the left with his eyes in a very hard glance. And he said, I've been having these angina attacks. And ever since, really regularly, within 2 weeks, I'll have another one. And I said, wait, stop just a minute. What are you picturing when you say that? And he said, nothing. And I said, yeah, you are. Trust me, do it. Say it all again. And I stopped him when he did that. And he said, oh my God, I am. I'm seeing the picture on the piano of my father and seven uncles, all of whom died of heart attacks. So I used reciprocal inhibition for that memory. Remember, I mentioned that sometimes in a trauma, you have to undo some other thing that's interfering with retrieving the resources. And I heard from him, and that was the last anxiety attack he had. I heard from him a year or so before his death, about a year and a half before he died. He called me and he said, you know, I just want to thank you. It's been years since you did that. I don't know if you remember. Oh, I certainly do remember because it was very cool. And he says, I've not had another anxiety attack since then. He would have been taking, nitroglycerin or something for the rest of his life if it hadn't have been for that. Now, that's what the EMDR does. It interrupts the ability. They would have simply interrupted the ability to focus on that, to unconsciously trigger that picture by that muscle set of the eye. You know, I recognized it and I didn't do EMDR with it. I instead, which would be like, well, have an angina attack now and we'll and watch my finger. That would have been a little difficult.
But can hypnosis do the same thing or no?
Yeah, I did that in hypnosis.
That was okay. That's a fascinating concept.
Because, you know, you can easily entertain opposites. Hilgard's idea of trance logic, where I can concentrate on two opposite things and simultaneously, and then I can bring them together. Integrity of the longer lasting experiences and the more well integrated positive experiences destroy the integrity of the temporary new one that was caused on the piano.
I know we only have a few minutes together. I have three questions left, I guess. One of them is dispelling a myth. I think it's a myth. One of them is, hey, I'm not going to Steve Langton's for hypnosis. What happens if he tells me to do things I don't want to do? If I'm starting to go and depositing checks into his account that are $5,000 apiece, or I can never get out of this trance. But I've heard on the other side, you're conscious enough to prevent that. What's your answer to that?
Well, yes, if you feel that way, don't come see me. I don't want to wrangle with it. People, yeah, the idea, one of the surviving ideas from the myth of hypnosis is that it makes you do things, can make you do things that you wouldn't normally do, even things that are illegal or immoral. That's largely been shown to be false, but mostly the underlying premise is what's false, is that you control the other person, especially the way the traditional hypnotist does things. There is a great deal of aspect of control. I'm telling you to follow my voice. I'm telling you to do what I say. But fortunately, that whole trend is largely disappearing. The idea from Erickson's work that is beginning to be prominent is that you help the person with ambiguous enough suggestions that they project into that ambiguity what they need to change, and they're in control. Erickson said he wants the client to do all the work. He wants them to do a great deal of thinking and a reorganizing of experience. So rather than tell them what to think, what you do in hypnosis is get the client to be able to let, I guess, what if you were a Gestalt therapist, you'd say the ideas in the background to move into the foreground when they've been forced into the background again and again by this Gestalt that your conscious mind keeps putting together. Hypnosis allows you to relax that conscious mind, allows previously unrecognized useful information and experiences from the background to come into the foreground and be reassociated and be used. So yeah, there's no telling a person that they're going to put money in your checking account and thinking that's going to happen, because A, you don't control them. B, you wouldn't do something that's against your ethical values in the long run, at least. You wouldn't kill somebody, for example. And that's not how, hopefully, ethical and modern hypnotists work. Stage hypnotists, on the other hand, actually use a very similar technique, you know, that and they also pick people who are extremely hypnotizable from the audience. They don't pick somebody that's not going to go into trance and who's not going to try to please in the context of that entertainment situation. But we're not in an entertainment situation, so no one's going to be clucking like a chicken. We're in a serious clinical situation where you have real personal problems and experiences you want to resolve in as quick a, as painless and smooth a way as possible. And that's what we're trying to accomplish and do, you know, in a modern hypnosis setting.
That's the neat thing about it is when you were talking, by the way, folks, if you want more information, you go to langton.com, L-A-N-K-T-O-N. And that's the neat thing about it, as you're describing it today, how would you say precise you are at a lot of times, what you're focusing on, you're targeting, you have a plan when you go in with the clinical hypnosis. It isn't just some kind of, let's see what happens. You actually have an idea of what you're targeting. So it makes a big difference. I don't know why I'm bringing this question up. I guess I'm just kind of curious to see, are there things people should be aware of before they go to see a clinical hypnotist or see you? In other words, it's not a good idea, I'm assuming, to be hallucinogens aren't going to be helpful here. So and R.D. Lang and Baba Ram Dass aren't going to be very helpful in this situation. But anything else, like should they not be on medications? Does that interfere?
John Lilly won't either. John Lilly won't be helpful either. He was experimenting with ketamine way back in the 50s.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about it. Anything like that?
Don't be high when you come, and because I'll send you home if you're high. When you began asking, I had a response, and then you started mentioning all these names, and I forgot what I was going to say. The idea that I had originally to say was it's not a magic bullet. And that's probably the major reason that I turn people down, is they think that, well, I've tried everything else. Now I should try hypnosis, or my Even physicians will refer, you know, don't have a very, some of them don't have a good knowledge of what's going on here. And they'll refer. In fact, I think the person that referred the woman with the nausea to me expected that I would suggest she stop vomiting somehow and that that would solve the problem. And that had, you know, and that's simply not how it works. And it's certainly not a magic bullet for complicated things. Like I've never dated a woman before and I want to use hypnosis, so I'll become Don Juan. No, you, and as far as altered states go, reaching altered states, Erickson did an experiment once with Aldous Huxley.
And, oh, yeah.
He had notes on that, but they got burned. He tried to reconstruct, when the office caught fire, he tried to reconstruct them, but he could only sort of partially do that. And Aldous Huxley's, you know, he's pretty much left alone. Erickson's pretty much left him alone to do what he was going to, you know, Aldous Huxley put himself into his own little trance and tried to alter his experience as much as possible. But hypnosis is not a tool for developing ESP, at least not yet. If it's possible, it hadn't come my way, a tool for developing ESP or psychokinesis or seeing ghosts or calling down flying saucers or anything. These events may occur and people may have some kind of reality that is related to their meditation and their concentration, but it's not part of what clinical hypnosis is all about. There's no empirical data on this to support it. So even if it were to be true that you could, there's some new movement, you know, where you meditate and use lasers and point to the sky and you can attract the spacecraft, apparently. Meditation is the key here, apparently. Well, there's no, that's not in any peer-reviewed journal and it's not scientific. If you have somebody, another thing to know, see a licensed professional. There are a lot of lay organizations out there that'll give you a certified clinical hypnotist certificate after a few weekends of training. That doesn't mean they know anything about how the human being works and reinforcement or psychodynamic theory or anything else. So sadly, that doesn't mean that if you graduate from graduate school either, but at least there's a good chance, you know, that you're going to be ahead of the game. So you go to the, you find out from the state board if the person has a license for a licensed professional counselor for clinical social work, marriage and family therapy, a licensed psychologist or a clinical psychologist or psychiatrist. And if they don't have one of those licenses offered by a state regulatory board, do not be seeing them for hypnosis or, you know, whatever other thing they might be offering to cure your psychological problem. It's literally against the law for someone who's unlicensed to be treating psychological problems, although the law seldom comes to play to arrest those people. So that's a very important thing. Make sure you're working with a licensed professional.
That leads me to, I guess, my last question is, it's interesting because I have seen those before. And a lot of times they claim that it can help people stop smoking. That was one of the big things for a while with hypnosis. Is that accurate or?
Yeah, there's a great deal of work that's still done and published and even researched on that. The idea, it comes again in two formats. There's the one where you're being told not to and to think how yucky it would be. And then there's another protocol which has to do with recognizing what your psychological factors led you to do that and how to solve them without doing that anymore. The former happens in groups usually and quite lucrative for the people who do that. And often those are stage hypnotists that do it because it's right up their alley with the authoritarian approach, direct suggestion to remove a symptom and tell people what to think and promote the idea that you're putting an idea in the back of their mind that they have to follow.
So to summarize everything we said somewhat, it sounds like hypnosis is an adjunct, as you mentioned earlier, to therapy. And it's really not, it's a standalone. It's not a standalone. It has to be used with therapy. And there's precise tools and precise things that you're targeting, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So far, so good. And there is also the use of ambiguity so that you can find out what to target. I might add. People project into that ambiguity, and you have to terminate this pretty quickly. So I don't know if I should tell you another short story or not.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, one of the techniques that Erickson used were homework extramural assignments, things outside the office. And he had people do the hardest things you can imagine suggesting they do. And I won't tell you because it'll take up too much time. But back in 82, and I was finishing up, or in 81, really, when I was finishing up writing The Answer Within, I kept wondering, how in the world does he know that the outcome is going to turn out the way he does? And whenever I'd ask him, how did you know that having the guy drive to Tucson and put this sign on his chest and this woman handing out flowers on the street, how did you know it was going to turn out that way? And all he would say was, I followed the client's own experiential language. And I'm like, well, that's no help. I can't replicate that intervention with that advice. And then it dawned on me, he did not know the outcome. He simply continued to communicate until he hit a therapeutic outcome, and then he'd stop and have a great story. And so I called it ambiguous function assignment. And I published it a couple of places. The first time I actually did it was I lived in Florida. Guy was coming in from New Orleans, and I couldn't understand what his problem was. And he wasn't helpful in telling me. I couldn't figure out why at the time. So he comes in, and the night before I see him, I meet with him so he knows where my office is. And I said, I want you to do something. You're staying at the Holiday Inn on the beach. You can either go down to the beach at 7:35 is sundown. If you live near the beach, you always know it's sundown. And watch the sun go down while you do this exercise. Or you can go to the top of the Holiday Inn where they have windows all around. And I happen to know that there's like room dividers, and you can get in the back and sit on the chairs. No one will even see you there. So you'll be all alone. And then I went back and forth. I don't know which is better, this one or that one. So he had a bind of comparable alternatives on where to do it, but not whether he should do it. And then I said, get two spoons from the Holiday Inn restaurant, hold them together so that the curvature of the spoons just almost touch, but not quite, and watch the sun go down through that vortex. And come back tomorrow and tell me why I had you do it. Now, do you think I had a clue? No clue whatsoever. It was totally ambiguous. I knew it would be safe and not yucky and legal and ambiguous. And he came back and I said, how about what happened with that homework assignment? And he started crying and he said, it was just beautiful. It was wonderful. You were so right. And I said, well, I didn't know what was so right because I didn't know what it meant to him. And I kept asking him. It took a long time to get the specifics. He just kept saying, you were so right. That was perfect. You know, I couldn't see it was just normal objects, but they were so beautiful. Yeah. But I couldn't figure out. It took me a while to get him to say what it meant. Finally, he said, that's why I had the affair. I stopped being able to see the beauty of the world through my own eyes, and I could only see it through hers. And that's why I had the affair.
Oh, wow.
So now, because of the ambiguity, we have a target that we can work on, which is the guilt that he had, the problems in his marriage, his contribution to that, we could change and so on. But I swear I could not get him to tell me that his problem was that he felt horrible for having the affair. And that's also why he came to Florida. He was well known in that area of Louisiana, and he didn't want therapists up there knowing what had happened.
Crazy story. I'm glad you shared it.
But that's the use of ambiguity in trance as well, which you get a lot of from Dr. Erickson.
Fascinating stuff. I could be here all day talking about this stuff. Crazy stories. Mr. Langton, thank you so much again for spending the time with us.
Well, thank you. It's a real opportunity to help educate, and I hope we've done a little bit of that. Thanks for having me on to do that.
Absolutely. And I'm sure we have. Again, folks, you can find more information about Steve Langton at LANKTON, Langton.com, Langton.com. Go check it out. He's got, like I said, he's written a lot of books. I've read a lot of his books. They're great books. I highly recommend it. Check it out. And remember what to do, folks. Share, subscribe, hit that like button. You know we like it. I might even hypnotize you to say it.